Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, an update on a growing rebellion in France against center-right President Macron's attack against labor unions there, and also attacking what is left of France's welfare state. On the ground in France, we get the latest from Stéphane Enjolras, National Secretary and Spokesperson for Solidarité. For our weekly roundtable on the international front, North Korea continues to provoke. The UN again slaps sanctions, but with the intervention of Russia and China, the sanctions were watered down. The United States, with all the saber-rattling rhetoric by Trump, is left with few options on North Korea. Also, is India and Japan's cozying up part of a realignment in the region? It seems whatever the cover, all guns, militarily and economically, are pointed at China. China continues to barrel forward to challenge Western nations for global influence. And the United States is sending mixed messages about Iran as Israel frets, and some wonder if the Saudis are angling to become a nuclear power. In the Americas, the catastrophe of Hurricane Irma and the devastating earthquake in Mexico have revealed a double standard in the value of human life, of who deserves relief and who can wait or fend for themselves. Also in Florida, that voted for Trump, many who oppose big government are now clamoring for big government relief. Will this have a ripple effect, say, on the human right to health care? This as Bernie Sanders introduced his health care for all bill. And on immigration and Charlottesville, the Trump administration approach continues to be divide and rule. Meanwhile, the Democratic leadership seem enthralled that Trump, quote unquote, now likes us, whatever that means. With DACA being used as a bargaining chip, how will immigration reform play out? Will Democrats buy the good immigrant, bad immigrant strategy in moving forward? Our panelists are Bill Gallegos, Jackie Goldberg, Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. A bomb attack on a London Underground train today has injured at least 22 people. None of the injuries are reported to be life-threatening. 18 were taken to hospitals by ambulance, and 4 showed up at hospitals themselves. Police say the blast at Parsons Green subway station was caused by an improvised explosive device. No one has been arrested so far. Assistant London Police Commissioner Mark Rowley said several agencies are investigating the incident.
The investigation is being led by the Metropolitan Police Counterterrorism Command, part of the National Counterterrorism Policing Network. And there are many urgent inquiries ongoing now, with hundreds of detectives involved, looking at CCTV, forensic work, and speaking to witnesses.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May called an emergency cabinet meeting. She tweeted encouragement to the victims of the attack and to first responders. President Trump condemned the attack on Twitter and argued for tighter controls on the internet, which he said is the main recruitment tool for extremist groups. North Korea launched another missile today, which passed over the Japanese island of Hokkaido as residents were just starting their day. The missile landed in the Pacific Ocean. Community loudspeakers instructed people to get inside any building and go to the basement. TV stations relayed the warnings, and residents of several prefectures received the emergency messages on their cell phones. Trains and subways on Hokkaido briefly stopped for safety checks. It's the second time Japan's emergency J alert system kicked into action in less than a month, following an earlier North Korean missile flyover late last month. Japanese officials say there is little more that towns can do to prepare except for raising public awareness about how to respond. The missile launch followed the UN Security Council's unanimous imposition of new sanctions on North Korea on Monday after its sixth nuclear test. Google faces a new lawsuit accusing it of gender-based pay discrimination. A lawyer representing three female former Google employees is seeking class action status for the claim. The suit, filed yesterday in San Francisco Superior Court, follows a federal labor investigation that made a preliminary finding of systemic pay discrimination among the 21,000 employees at Google's headquarters in Mountain View. The initial stages of the review found women earned less than men in nearly every job classification. Google disputes those findings and says its analysis shows no gender pay gap. Florida's post-Irma recovery includes urgent efforts to protect its vulnerable elderly residents after a string of nursing home deaths. Several nursing homes have been evacuated because of a lack of power or air conditioning, while utility workers race to help dozens of others still lacking electricity Thursday. Homebound seniors found help from charities, churches, and authorities. Meanwhile, detectives were combing through Hollywood, Florida facilities where eight elderly residents died amid sweltering heat. Officials said that statewide, 64 nursing homes were still waiting for full power as of Thursday. The separate Florida Assisted Living Association said many of its South Florida members lacked electricity. The group was working on a precise count. University of California, Berkeley police say there have been 4 to 5 arrests related to protests in Berkeley, all on city property. Hundreds protested outside a speech by right-wing commentator and former Breitbart editor Ben Shapiro. The demonstrations were mostly peaceful. UC officials called last night's Shapiro speech a successful event. And, as Mira Nablusi reports, security measures for the event cost the UC an estimated $600,000.
Dan Mugloff, UC Berkeley spokesperson, says closing the campus is unfortunate, but the UC administration is trying to accommodate the rights of all students.
We have offered support to students from no matter who they are or what they believe in, whether they be conservative students who are concerned about the possibility that the Antifa returns, or students from the other part of the political spectrum.
Berkeley City spokesperson Matai Chako said major commercial streets adjacent to the campus were closed.
Among the reasons that we've done so is concerns out of Charlottesville and the way that people have used cars. That certainly has played a factor in how we think of safe spaces.
According to university officials, the security and preparedness costs are estimated to be around $600,000. UC Berkeley is also expected to host other right-wing figures between September 24th and the 27th. Where former Trump advisor Steve Bannon himself is expected to speak. The event is known as the Free Speech Week. Reporting from Berkeley for KPFA Evening News, this is Mira Nablusi.
I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And before we welcome our weekly roundtable panelists, we want to just spend a few minutes on an important struggle going on in France that has wide implications not only for the rest of Europe, but for those of us in the United States. President Macron of France elected as a center-right candidate. The fast rise of his new party bypassed the traditional political parties in France in many ways was a response to both the ultra-right candidate Marine Le Pen and the left candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon, co-founder of France Unbowed. Macron has promised a series of anti-labor reforms as well as other measures that would further undermine what's left of France's welfare state. On September 12th, the General Confederation of Labor, the CGT, along with a major student organization and other supporters, took to the streets en masse protesting Macron's policies. Macron added fuel to the fire by referring to those who oppose his measures as slackers. Rikers. And he was nowhere in sight on September 12th. He chose this time to visit French colonies in the Caribbean, hit hard by Hurricane Irma. Indeed, France has been criticized for its tepid response to the hurricane, with aid slow to arrive and also limited. On the ground in France, I'd like to welcome our guest, Stéphane Ollongeron, National Secretary and Spokesperson for Solidaire. Stéphane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your interest.
Okay. Stéphane, Macron, in moving this, he's bypassing usual parliamentary procedures to press forward on this. How is he doing this, and what is the impact of him moving in this way with these reforms?
Yes, he's pushing, in fact, by executive orders to shortcut debates and democracy in parliament. Indeed, there are possibilities of such a process in the French constitution. But in the past times, no one was using it. It's something new and is following the path of the former president, François Hollande, and his government, who they used a procedure that called the Law 49-3 that can also shortcut debates in the assembly, in the people assembly. So, in fact, yes, they don't want political debates. They don't want social debates about what you were calling, and it's just to say so, an attack against what is left of a welfare state in France. And I think they want to do it because they don't want social strikes and social social meetings in the street. They don't want it, and they have other reforms to pass in the next month that will end welfare state if it happens.
Yeah, and Stéphane, with the protests, we do know that there were mass protests on September 12th. There's another one scheduled for September 21st, and yet another one from Insoumise, Malichon's organization, on September 23rd. But what happened? Because it seems as though some of the labor unions are split, because not all of them participated on the 12th and instead chose to have a kind of listening sessions, I suppose, with Macron that has ended up in not much of anything. What's their story right now?
It's a very difficult thing. I should say that more and more there's a gap between two kind of unionism in France. The first one are calling themselves responsible unions. That means it's one of the most the biggest union in France, called CFDT, that signs everything that this government and previous governments were doing. So we don't call it an union job for ourselves. And there are other unions that are called radical, but we don't. I don't know what is to be radical. We just do our union job to protect the workers. So yes, there's something moving. I should say that in the 80s and in some countries in Europe, like in Germany, like in Belgium, there have been a change in the way unions consider themselves. They were the government told them, so now you will be in charge of pensions, you will be in charge of social budgets, etc., and they become less combative. And I think that something like this that is happening in France for some unions.
Right, and that might explain, because there was a poll that the labor union support in France is down to only about 36%. But do you think that Macron is seeing himself as like a Margaret Thatcher in the UK when she went after the miners union and really it was a huge blow to undermining the labor movement in the UK, or Ronald Reagan with his attack on the air traffic controllers in the United States, and unions in so many ways are under attack and haven't been able to fully recover. So is Macron trying to basically take France in that same direction, do you think? And finally, if you could respond to that, and finally, your expectations for this movement, are you expecting it to grow? Stéphane.
Yes, I think you're right when you're talking about Reagan busting unions and this famous strike of in air traffic. I think we can speak of union busting in France today, because this reform that we are fighting against will, for example, decrease the number of employee representative by merging different representation, and will also decrease power of unions in factories and by some laws that it include. So yes, they are attacking unions. Unions that are doing their job of unions. I think you to have a comparison, you had it in the United States. Maybe 50 years ago, I think with the Taft-Hartley Act, that was, I think, an attack against unions that were powerful in the United States in past decades. I think there's something like this that is happening in France. What we are expecting for the next weeks or next month, first of all, some unions that weren't with us on September the 12th, there is movement inside of them, and we hope that teams of these unions will join demonstration and strike. And I think it's not only an union question. In a classical term and conception of it, because there are other there is this law, but there are other laws in France that Macron is now leading that are striking poor people in France. And these people, we hope, we think, that they will also join a contestation and future strike and mobilization, because there are other reforms after the law code, the actual law code, pensions and other things that will be, you said it well, the end of welfare state in France.
Right. Well, on that note, we'll continue to follow this story. And Stéphane, we hope that you will join us again to update us. All the best to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All righty. And our guest, Stéphane Olderon, National Secretary and Spokesperson for Solidaire, based in France. Attacks on labor unions continuing in France, as they are under attack here in the United States. And now we would like to welcome our weekly roundtable. I'd like to welcome Jackie Goldberg. She has served in the California State Assembly, also on the City Council, the Los Angeles School Board, and currently on contract with the Mayor of Los Angeles office to help rehire people who have been laid off. She's been an educator all of her life. Jackie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bill Gallegos, longtime Chicano liberation and environmental justice activist. He's the author of The Sunbelt Strategy in Chicano Liberation and Reflections on the Green Economy. He is the former executive director of Communities for a Better Environment, one of the leading environmental justice organizations in the United States. Bill, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Dr. Gerald Horn, the Morse Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, the Artist as Revolutionary. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so we are going to actually start on the international front. And North Korea fired yet another missile over Japan, the first doing so on August 29th. The UN Security Council is set again to meet. As I said in the intro, sanctions have already been slapped on North Korea. They were watered down, it is said, with the intervention of Russia and China. And it seems as though the United States really don't have a whole heck of a lot of options here. What we're going to do before we have all of you weigh in, not only in North Korea, but other issues on the international front, let's get a little look at what war with North Korea might look like. This is from the Wall Street Journal as the source.
North Korea's missile program is racing ahead.
Mr. President, will you attack North Korea?
And U.S. President Donald Trump is using language that we've never heard a president using on Korea.
Fire and fury.
And that's led to open talk about military options on the Korean Peninsula, something that you generally don't hear very often.
We have many military options, and the president wanted to be briefed on each one of them.
A war would put the lives of millions of civilians at risk, so it's still an extremely unlikely scenario.
But if it were to happen, here's how experts see it playing out. What could trigger a military intervention?
Experts say the U.S. could take action to stop Pyongyang from developing a nuclear-tipped missile capable of reaching New York or Washington. The U.S. has also warned North Korea that it could take military action if North Korea were to engage in a particularly provocative fashion.
Any threat to the United States or its territories, including Guam or our allies, will be met with a massive military response.
Analysts say that Pyongyang is highly unlikely to start a conflict unless it believes that the U.S. is about to strike and that the regime itself is under threat. In times of high stress, even a mishap could become a trigger, like a North Korean missile test that inadvertently lands onto Japanese soil, or a disaster like an accident at North Korea's nuclear reactor. So what would a U.S. military operation look like? Washington could try to take Kim Jong-un's regime by surprise and conduct a short, intense military campaign.
What happened is a massive American air campaign. Well, that was the plan in 1994 for the beginning of the North Korean nuclear program. So I have the feeling that the Americans would target a lot of North Korean facilities in a big, big strike.
American military could rely on forces already in the region in order to avoid tipping off North Korea, such as using aerial bombers, land-based cruise missiles, and submarine-launched ballistic missiles.
Through surgical strikes, the U.S. Army would destroy Pyongyang's nuclear facilities, missile launch sites, and mobile launch vehicles.
But there's a catch. The U.S. may not know where all of the North's nuclear assets and its missile facilities are.
If there's a catch big time, like the possibility of millions of people being killed, and Trump made a remark of like, well, if, you know, millions of people in South Korea die, you know, so be it. But, you know, a lot of us are hoping that he's really not so crazy to go there. Bill Gallegos, we'll talk with you to get your response to North Korea, but the whole North Korea, China, Russia nexus, and Iran. We can't leave Iran out of that because they're also trying to stem Iran's development of a nuclear weapon. And it seems as though the Saudis are really angling, you know, in that direction as well. But Bill Gallegos, your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think, you know, the situation with North Korea is often portrayed as without resolution, without options for the Trump administration. But actually, there is one. And recent history points to what that option is, which is negotiations, which happened in the Clinton administration, and in which the North actually shelved its nuclear development program and its missile program in return for a number of concessions that were made by the Clinton administration. The Bush administration, after it took power following the elections, trashed all of those agreements, and that North Korea revived its nuclear program and its missile program because they were part of the Axis of Evil. and saw what had happened in the Middle East. So I think the Chinese and the Russians and the North Koreans have consistently said there is a solution to this problem, and that's negotiations. The North has been very clear that they want a resolution. There's an armistice in place in the Korean Peninsula, not a peace treaty. They want a peace treaty. They want to know that they are not going to be targeted for destruction by the United States. And they've been very clear about that. And I think they have been pushing, they're pushing their missile launches and their nuclear tests towards that end. They have consistently said that this is the way out. And the Chinese and the Russians have said that, but before the United States and South Korea did their war games on August 20th, the Chinese and the Russians said, step down, don't do it. You need to go in the other direction, which is sitting down with the North Koreans and others in the region and working out a peace treaty and a resolution to this, including a pledge by the United States not to attack North Korea. Not something that is in the insane asylum. That is a reasonable demand by any nation, any sovereign nation. So I think that's what's going on here, is both sides are ratcheting it up. But I think from the North Koreans, they're often portrayed as being, as their leader being insane and crazy and having no thoughts about the consequences of their actions. I think what they're saying is we're standing up against the most well-armed nuclear military superpower in history, and we're going to keep pushing until somebody sits down at the table with us and takes us seriously.
Right. And Jackie Goldberg, picking up from Bill's points there, you know, often North Korea is also portrayed as being, you know, extremely poor. And an article in Vox said the GDP per capita is about $1,000, about 1/28 of South Korea's, that there are chronic shortages of food, medical supplies, you know, et cetera. But that is in contrast with what is seen in North Korea now, where there's been a building boom. People are, you know, it is reported, and this is reported in Consortium News, restaurants and shops, coffee shops are everywhere. People seem better dressed. Young people are running around with mobile phones and tablet computers, and even in the countryside. People are having solar panels, television, etc. So on the one hand, you have that Kim Jong-un is insane and that he's starving his people out and people are so impoverished there. I'm sure there still is a lot of poverty as there is in many parts of the world. So your thoughts on what's going on. And also, I wonder if this kind of cozying up that happens with Japan and India, for example, they met recently and it was this kind of bromance going with the Indian Prime Minister Modi and the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. And if that is also a response to China and China's growing power and influence. Any thoughts on all of that, Jackie?
I think a lot of it is a response to China. I think there is, throughout all of Asia, the notion that somehow or another alliances are realigning. And you have threats in a lot of different directions. What does Japan and India getting together do to Pakistan? How does that make them feel? Is Pakistan now moving closer to Iran, which some folks are saying? I've just read something this morning about that. I think basically, though, the one overwhelming thing that I think people have to remember about North Korea is that punishment does not work. Okay? Mm. It just doesn't work. It's never worked. It's never worked because their resistance to pressure is extraordinary. They get trade and the investment from China, but without it, they would still survive, and they know they would still survive. That means that this continuous harping by Trump that China needs to do this or China needs to do that, China knows what will work. It won't work. It doesn't work to impose greater destruction, greater famine on North Korea, because over the period of the last several presidents, we've seen that it is not possible to force them into negotiations by threatening them. And in fact, it has just the opposite effect. It proves to the Korean people, North Korean people, that what Kim Jong says is true, that the United States is out to destroy them, that they want to harm their people, that they have no regard for North Koreans, and so forth and so on. And it makes that harder. Famine in North Korea, it doesn't work. You don't do it. And what does work is saying is the kinds of things that Trump does with Putin, a little complimentary of how Ung has gotten so far technology, and saying, well, we admire that your great technological advances. Let's see if we can use them for peace instead of war. Let's sit down. I think if you take a look at the New York Times the other day, had this article about China not being able to solve the North Korean problem. You'll see a real outline in that article that talks about the fact that you really cannot force North Korea to stop doing what it's doing. You can only do that by having a discussion with them, and I agree with Bill entirely, by saying, you know, we're not your enemy, we're not coming after you, we're not going to try regime change, we don't intend to bomb you. It is time to formally end the Korean War. Let's sit down and talk. I think that if the United States were to take that position, as both Russia and China and many other parts of the world are urging us to do, you would see the North Koreans respond. I think this continuously demonizing them in the American press just makes it easier for Trump to do some of the things that he's done that really puts the whole region at risk.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, I mean, you had the UN, okay, new sanctions on North Korea. North Korea responded by firing off a missile that traveled 2,300 miles. This is according to South Korea's military. And that range is significant because, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, North Korea demonstrated that it could reach Guam with this missile. And, you know, so there's that going on the one hand. And then when you look at the kind of realignment that Jackie just referred to and I mentioned earlier, and you have China on the one hand, increasingly a major world power, challenging even the United States in that direction economically. And there's some moves also militarily happening. You have Russia. You have also Israel, a nuclear power. You have Iran. They're trying to keep Iran from being a nuclear power. And these are some of the major players, if you look at it. And one has to wonder if Saudi Arabia is also trying to get into that category with their moves. I mean, the horrible, horrific, catastrophic war going on in Yemen, and then their moves against Qatar. So it seems as though all of this, even though it seems as though it's not connected, it really is in terms of that kind of global realignment and a bipolar world, Dr. Horn.
Well, just like the war in Korea in 1950 to 1953 had its ultimate target, the People's Republic of China, I think the crisis in North Korea has as its ultimate target a rising China, as your words suggest, that there's a developing dangerous alliance involving Japan, India, United States, Republic of Korea, Australia, to contain and encircle China. But I must warn Washington that just like in the 1970s when the United States aligned with China to help to weaken the Soviet Union, I think the ultimate result of this new alignment in 2017 will be the development of a Japan-India axis, a relationship that goes back 2,500 years to the founding of Buddhism, and of course, even flowered during World War II, if you might recall, when there was enormous sympathy for Japan in India. I should also say that Mr. Trump is being forced to back away from some of his campaign promises as a result of his ham-fisted strategy in Northeast Asia. For example, he's dropped the threat to end the Republic of Korea, South Korea, U.S. trade agreement. He's dropped the threat to make Seoul pay more for the anti-missile defense system in South Korea, which, of course, is targeting China much more so than North Korea. He's also refused a Chinese offer to limit steel capacity production, which was a major demand of the United States Steel Workers Union, in part because he wants to keep China, from his point of view, on the hot seat. I think that it's also fair to say that this India-China confrontation is complicating the development of an alternative framework of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, which just met in China a few days ago. And I should also say that Russia, which is also in that vicinity, also in that neighborhood, is an ultimate target of this crisis in North Korea. Russia also might be the key to solving this crisis, since in many ways its relations with the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, is better than China's relations with the DPRK. But in that context, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is raising quite a large amount of hysteria about these military maneuvers that are taking place in Eastern Europe as we speak. That only involves about 13,000 troops, but you would think it was 300,000, given the amount of hysteria that is unfolding. In any case, it's clear what we need to do at this point. We need to press the demand for a so-called double freeze. That is to say, in return for North Korea freezing its nuclear capacity, the United States and South Korea will freeze its military maneuvers, which are targeting North Korea. Washington has rejected that thus far, but obviously it has to be forced upon them.
Right. Well, we'll continue to see how all of this plays out. Thank you, Dr. Horn. We are going to take our station break, a short station break, and coming up, we'll turn our attention to the National Front and the rest of the Americas. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Okay, and the great Edwin Starr, the song is War. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're just joining us for our weekly roundtable from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And you could check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org, where all of our shows are archived there, and there's a description for each show. And we're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners on the Korean Peninsula. It is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Bill Gallegos, Jackie Goldberg, Dr. Gerald Horn. Now, the Hurricane Irma, first Hurricane Harvey, but then Hurricane Irma, the Mexico earthquake. I mean, it's just incredible what has been going on in the environment over the last few weeks, really. And they really have revealed a double standard in the value of human life, of who deserves relief, who can wait or fend for themselves. And also with, you know, Trump just yesterday was again questioning whether climate change is real, and says, well, we've had really bad hurricanes before. And meanwhile, in terms of greenhouse gases, the Trump EPA has rolled back water pollution limits for coal plants. You know, look, need I say more? We're going to go right to you, Bill Gallegos, because it was interesting that Trump said, well, it was cell phone, you know, a cell phone issue that meant that that Trump waited a week or close to a week to even call the president of Mexico after that devastating earthquake. But Bill Gallegos, your comments on this kind of double standard revealed in these natural catastrophes.
Yes. You know, well, Margaret, there's consistently been a problem that the populations that contribute the least to global warming suffer the most. And that's true in the global south. And that's also true in areas impacted by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, where the global south in the global north, the populations of African Americans and Latinos in particular, have the lightest carbon footprint of all populations. In fact, all communities of color have the lightest carbon footprint of all of our populations, but also always suffer the most. They always live in the areas that are most impacted, most vulnerable to climate change and climatic impacts. And that's what's happened in Texas, and that's what's happened in Florida. And I think what's very important now is what's going to happen with the rebuilding, because we have a very illustrative negative example with what happened in New Orleans, where that city was rebuilt after Hurricane Katrina in a way that displaced the historically majority black population, destroyed public education, turned all of New Orleans schools into private charter schools, and really illustrated in a horrible sense what Naomi Klein has called disaster capitalism, taking advantage of a disaster to exacerbate all of the inequalities and all of the horrible aspects of capitalism. So I think that's what's at stake now in Texas and in Florida. And I think it's very, very important for all of us to support the organizations on the ground, the grassroots organizations in Florida. And there's a new coalition that includes the New Florida Majority, SEIU, Miami Worker Center, and others that are saying we are positioned to fight for an equitable and sustainable rebuilding of our state. But that's, you know, there's very powerful class forces that are going to be involved in that arena. And the Trump administration and the federal government, of course, is likely to come down on the side of the corporations, the fossil fuel industries, and those that will want to take advantage of this catastrophe to further gentrify and exacerbate inequality in those areas. So I think that's what's at stake here. And of course, the media and the government continue to deny that climate change was any part of these catastrophes, one after the other, wildfires, droughts, floods, hurricanes, at record levels every year, every season. And there continues to be a denial. And I think it's on the progressive sector and led by the environmental and climate justice community to make certain that this is front and center in any discussion of what are the causes and what are the solutions to the these problems going forward.
Right. And Bill, also very briefly, as we're getting close to the top of the hour, your response to what's going on now with DACA and Trump now negotiating and allegedly having made a deal with Democrats in relation to DACA, but also what some people are worried about with DACA being used as a bargaining chip and this whole division of the good immigrant, bad immigrant, and, you know, who deserves help, et cetera. Comment from you, Bill.
Well, I we should all be supportive of efforts to preserve the DACA program as established under the Obama administration.
Yeah.
It's in the early discussions that are going on about this deal that Trump has cut. It doesn't look like that's exactly what's going on, and we don't know all of the details. But what does concern me is the idea that the trade-off here is not the border wall, but the beefing up of spending and programs along the further militarization of the border.
Mm-hmm.
And, we know now that the Border Patrol and the Immigration and Control Force in our site is not the largest federal police force in the country. It's an $18 billion at least annual budget. And when they say they're protecting the border, they're setting up checkpoints 50 and 60 miles from the border. So this has turned into an occupation army, primarily in Latino communities, all along the border and farther from the border. So it really concerns me that they are going to play the good immigrants, bad immigrants here. We will let the DACA recipients be protected, but we're going to set up a system that further represses the millions of other undocumented immigrants here. And just, we should also note, Margaret, that the House just passed what they call the Criminal Alien Gang Members Removal Act, that supposedly aimed at Salva Maratrucha and other immigrant gangs. But it looks like a measure that will really codify racial profiling.
Yeah.
And further restrict immigration, particularly from Central America. So there's a very dangerous set of discussions going on, and I think our demand has to be unconditional protection for the Dakistas, and there should not be any kind of negative trade-off. And I know that's going to be a very difficult situation because it's the Democratic Party leadership that is involved in these negotiations.
Yeah.
And, you know, they haven't exactly earned our trust. So I think there has to be what's going on right now, mass actions, legal actions, everything we can to preserve the DACA program, but without a negative trade-off.
Yeah, and Jackie Goldberg, I mean, looking again at the fact that certainly people in Florida now are clamoring for, quote unquote, big government. I mean, it's just been horrible. And I don't think we know the half of what's really going on in Florida. We know in the Caribbean region, you know, for the first time, you have an entire island of Barbuda uninhabited by people for the first time in 300 years. In St. Martin, they're talking about maybe having to evacuate everybody off that island because there's lack of food, running water, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, you have Macron of France turning up there. You have Boris from the UK going. These are the former colonial powers. You have the King of Netherlands turning up and Trump talking about going to the U.S. Virgin Islands. But meanwhile, there definitely has been a difference in the level and the swiftness of aid getting to the places that were hardest hit by Irma. Cuba, by the way, was also hit very hard. I mean, it took Venezuela to be some of the first on the ground with aid in some of the Caribbean islands. Okay, there's more distance than from Houston or from Florida, but also even in relation to the lack of attention to Mexico, it definitely, to me anyway, does seem to be a kind of a double standard that's going on here about whose life is valued more, who deserves more aid than anyone else. Any thoughts on this, Jackie Goldberg?
Well, I think that's a problem in general in our lives. I mean, that's always a problem in our lives. If you just take a look at the budget negotiations that are going on within the Republican Party, it's which part of the poor can we devastate the most and get away with it? So I don't think this is any new policy of people or new attitude of people or new direction for people. Unfortunately, there are those that are important, and they're in America, and they're in the better, quote, part neighborhoods in America, not the poorer neighborhoods in America. And the same thing is true. I mean, I was shocked and dismayed at how little we got on the earthquake in Oaxaca and in northern Guatemala, which was just a devastating earthquake. I think there's 80 or 100 dead, and that's before they cleared the rubble. So I think basically it's an effort always, and I agree entirely with Bill, the struggle really now in all of these places is how the recovery will be managed. And
yeah.
I was slightly enjoyed the fact that for the first time, people have been questioning that the Red Cross get all the money because the Red Cross really does, in my opinion, some very good things, and it does some very terrible things. Like, for example, in Florida, in some places, they weren't going to let people without documents into shelters. I mean, really? I mean, really? You were going to check to see if they were documented before they could come into shelters? So you can get the understanding that we have corporate responses and then we have people's responses. And I agree with Bill that what has to happen is that those of us around the country who are donating money, who are passionate about wanting to help not only Americans but those in the Caribbean and those in Guatemala and in Oaxaca who've been devastated, those of us who want to help need to be talking about not just how do we get resources to those areas, but to whom the resources go.
Absolutely.
In terms of making sure that this is done in a way that does not repeat the disasters that were after Katrina weighed in against New Orleans.
Right. And Jackie, we do want Dr. Horn to weigh in. But just very quickly, on this thing with the Democrats and Trump right now, I mean, for Chuck Schumer to be going on about, oh, I think he likes us, I think he likes me, you know, you know, a lot of people get really turned off by that kind of thing and wonder what that says about the Democratic leadership.
Well, I think that we are in a transition in the Democratic Party. Nothing happens quickly, but we are in a transition. The leadership, there are struggles in small towns, in cities, in national and state elections all over where a younger and more vibrant Democratic Party could emerge, and that it's being pushed back on by the elites and the what I call the political hacks of the Democratic Party, and there's a real struggle going on. I think how Schumer and Pelosi handle the DACA situation and handle a relationship with Trump will have a tremendous impact on how quickly or how slowly the transition of leadership occurs.
Yeah. Okay. Dr. Horn, you know, just yesterday, Trump was again reiterating his comments about both sides being violent in terms of Charlottesville on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, making some comments that he wants to strike some kind of deal in relation to DACA, but also just the exposure of the relationship of these colonial powers, former colonial and former colonial powers in relation to the Caribbean region. Dr. Horn, just some quick final thoughts from you.
Well, it's not just the Caribbean region. In Houston, you are seeing neoliberalism run amok. You see landlords evicting tenants on flimsy grounds because they feel they can now rent the apartments that are pretty penny to the newly homeless. You see thousands upon thousands of cars flooded and rotting out from the inside, now being repainted. They're going to be sold all over the country and all over the world.
Oh, my God.
The crisis, of course, has its beginnings, in a sense, in terms of the dearth of zoning regulations, building willy-nilly all over the place on wetlands, on floodplains, on prairies. And with regard to the Mexico crisis, I would hope that Washington is paying very close and careful attention. The New York Times reports this morning that 65% of people in Mexico have a negative opinion of the United States. A high-level Mexican delegation was at the BRICS meeting in China just a few days ago, and I don't think that Mexico will be happy about this latest report from the Phoenix New Times that suggests that Motel 6 and perhaps other hotel chains or turning over the registration of those with Spanish surnames to ICE, the immigration authorities, and then the immigration authorities come to arrest people in their hotel rooms. I would hope that the hotel workers in the United States of America, which has a strong presence in Southern California in particular, would pay very close and careful attention to that particular issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Horn and Bill Gallegos, Jackie Goldberg, thank all of you for yet another fascinating roundtable. Thank you so much. We're out of time. So I'd like to thank all of today's guests. By the way, I'd like to thank Benoit Martin of Payday, they're part of the network of organizations of the Global Women's Strike, keeping a very close eye on what's going on in France, and was able to facilitate getting a high-profile guest from the labor movement in France. And I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our intern Sherelle Withers, assistant producer Stephanie Case, our engineer Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.